With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and we make no apology for the different theme music today. It's, of course, John Williams' great theme music of Superman, because we have witnessed the miracle of Headingley Mark II today, a superhuman effort by Ben Stokes creating another hero from Headingley. Of course, actually, it was interesting. Sky today started their programme with lots of material about the heroes that Headingley have created in the past, like, of course, Beefy Botham in 81, Mark Butcher as well playing that great innings against Australia to win a test match at Leeds. And today, we've just witnessed something quite remarkable. How Ben Stokes pulled that off. Must have been an amazing game to be at.
Probably the most remarkable game of cricket I've ever seen. The fluctuations, I think that was it, the fluctuations, 67 all out to 362 for nine, and England's highest ever winning score to take a test match in the fourth innings. I was actually commentating on World Service at the end, just summing it up for World Service at the end. I couldn't actually believe the words that I was saying, that England were on the verge of victory. They were two away from victory and the highest ever run chase they've had in 140 years of Test cricket. And yet here they were on the verge of something absolutely extraordinary. As you say, Headingley Mark II, another Headingley hero in Ben Stokes. Not the first time he's done it this summer, of course. He had a brilliant World Cup, not just in the final, but some really crucial innings in some of the group games as well, although the innings in the final was absolutely stunning. And he did it last week as well at Lord's. I mean, it's his two Sundays, two Ashes hundreds, and how they missed him last time when they went to Australia. I sense at the time they were going to miss him enormously, and I felt that Australia were bound to win the Ashes as a result. It just showed his value to the side today once more.
Yeah, I mean, it's in a way, yeah, you're right, because the whole point about a team is you've got a captain, especially in Test cricket. You've got a captain who makes the decisions and is the sort of the leader, but you also need someone to inspire a team as well, to be the warrior, if you like, the spiritual leader of the team. And I mentioned both that Mike Brearley had him in the 1981 series, and of course Michael Vaughan had Andrew Flintoff. But really, Joe Root down under 2 years ago had no one. He didn't have that warrior-like personality, the person who could drag a game out of the mire by the scruff of its neck and take England over the line. And that's what Stokes has proved he's able to do, not once in the World Cup final, but twice as well. And it's just, the man is bionic.
You had glimpses of it in that amazing innings you played in Cape Town. I said glimpses of it, you had more than a glimpse at it. It was just absolutely stunning innings, that 258. He's not really been able to reproduce that. Well, how do you reproduce an innings like that, where he was just hitting everything for four and six? But what the point I'm making is he's not really sort of hinted at that sort of dominance since. And of course, the other interesting point about his innings today was it was so slow for the first part of it. I mean, he, two not out, around about 70 balls faced. He was just digging in and biding his time and seeing where it took England. And then, of course, in the end, he just had to go for it. Sir Alistair Cook called it, he said, this must be the greatest innings ever by an England batsman in a test match. And we were sort of thinking about it, really. When what were the other great innings that have been played? Well, Gilbert Jessop. You remember him? No, you won't. But Gilbert Jessop.
Yeah, well, actually, it's a good point, because we're going to hear, funnily enough, a little bit about that Gilbert Jessop innings later in the show, because I've written this book, Cricket's Greatest Rivalry, The History of the Ashes in 12 Matches, and that's been out about a couple of weeks. It's already out of date, because this match at Headingley is one of the matches that should be in the book, and I'll have to do a rewrite. But one of those 12 matches is the game in 1902 at the Oval, when actually Gilbert Jessop produced an extraordinary innings to win a match by one wicket. So you'll hear a little bit of that story at the end of this podcast.
Well, we won't spoil it now. But anyway, Gilbert Jessop played an amazing innings back in 1902 in the Ashes. Graham Gooch's 154 against the West Indies, also at Headingley. I think that that was a remarkable innings as well, where he basically took on the West Indies fast bowlers on his own, scored a vast majority of England's runs, and they went on to win the Test match against that top-class West Indies side. Think of Mike Atherton in Johannesburg, that match-saving 180-odd, which he actually reminded me about today. I said, not many players. I was talking about Mark Butcher's 170 at Headingley in 2001. I said, just think of that. Not many players score 170 on the last day of the Test match. And he looked at me and smiled, and he said, well, I did, didn't I? in a really nice way. And I said, yeah, of course you did, but not all of those 185 came in the last day. He was well into his innings going into that final day. So that, others in Johannesburg. I mean, I'm talking about my lifetime, really. I mean, it's hard to talk about innings apart from the Jessop innings, which really stands out. I was getting Andrew Sampson, our statistician, just to give us a choice of great innings. But before early 70s, when I started watching cricket, I'm not as clued up about some of the great innings that have been played by England batsmen. But in the last 50 years, there cannot have been many better than that. Both of them, of course, in 1981, and the innings at Old Trafford when he took on Dennis Lilly and hooked him off his eyes, out towards the station at Old Trafford. So those are some of the great innings that have been played. But I think it's the context as well, isn't it? To win a match from this situation when the Ashes were on the line. If England lost, that was it. The Ashes have gone. So the only thing that could have been better in terms of context was if that was the innings that actually won the Ashes. But in terms of a peak performance. But I mean, to save the Ashes.
No, I completely
agree.
To
save the Ashes, Yoz.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with you. It's the best Test innings I've ever seen, and I think it's not just, as you say, because the Ashes was on the line, but actually the range of the innings as well. You said already that he made two from his first 70 balls, and he really got stuck in, and then he gradually flourished. But then he had to put on all those runs at the end with rabbits, it's effectively tail enders. So he put on 100 of the last four wickets. England, when Bairstow was out, England needed 114 to win. And the other players, so that's Archer, Wokes, Broad and Leach, contributed 18 of that 114 runs. So Stokes made 96 of the remaining 114 required to win from those last four wickets. He put on 76, of course, with the last man, Jack Leach, which is the third highest partnership for the last wicket to win a game. And also, it's the second highest partnership with a batsman scoring one or less in a Test match, because Leach only contributed one not out of that partnership of 76. There's only one higher, and that was Sanath Jayasuriya and Dinesh Fernando, who put on 102, with Fernando only making one run for Sri Lanka against Pakistan. So, all those stats weighed up together, plus the fact that he played so many gloriously and innovatively creative shots as well, like that amazing switch hit for six, like the ramp shot over the keeper's head off Pat Cummins, like the big hits off Nathan Lyon and the seam bowlers. I mean, it was just an innings of incredible range and repertoire, as well as extraordinary courage and stamina.
Yeah, and he was absolutely shattered at the end. And it's easy to forget as well, his bowling in that Australia second innings, because he bowled the whole of the final session on Friday. He bowled most of that first session on Saturday morning as well. Monumental bowling effort, 24.2 overs, 3 for 56. Just to hold Australia in check. Tim Payne was talking afterwards about, you know, the fact they could have been a bit more ruthless in their second innings and set England more. You know, with that lead of 112, a good base on which to build, they could have gone a bit higher and really just put the game out of England's reach. Having said that, you know, to set the team 359 and be bowled out for 67, you feel that should have been enough. And, you know, 99 times out of 100, of course, it would have been enough. 15 for 2, England were 286 for 9. Just Stokes and Leach there at the end. But, you know, again, the miracle of heading. I mean, it's hard to believe what happened, because it's so difficult to do what they did. It is also worth talking about the mistakes Australia made. I mean, they will point to the fact, quite rightly too, they will point to the fact that they were convinced they had Ben Stokes out. The technology said it was out. They didn't have a review left. Joel Wilson didn't raise his finger. That was a huge moment. England needed 2 to win. I thought it was one of the big mistakes that he made in his innings, Ben Stokes. One of the few mistakes, I should say, taking that shot on with 2 needed for victory. So there's that for Australia. Lyon dropping the ball as well when Jack Leach would have been run out. They had their chances, Australia. It was just one of those days. And they'll look back and curse their luck as well and curse their judgment, because they'd used up their review on a ridiculous LBW shout against Leach. Payne and Cummins involved in that. They had their opportunities and they blew it. And they had the chance to win the match despite Stokes' brilliance, and Australia have wasted that opportunity. And it's amazing the parallels, actually, between 1981 and 2019. Australia winning the first test in 1981. In 1981, they then drew at Lord's, and then they lost an incredible match at Headingley. Can history repeat itself?
It could well. And in fact, also in that comparison, the England captain was out for 2 noughts at Lord's in the second test. That, of course, was Ian Botham. Yeah. And he then became, obviously, not the captain for the third test. And England won that amazing match at Headingley. And the England captain this time has been out for 2 successive noughts, Joe Root, before his 77 here in this second inning. So there's lots of weird parallels. I noticed, by the way, talking of Nathan Lyon dropping that ball for the run out, a little sly tweet from Matt Prior, who was the subject of one or two bits of sledging from Nathan Lyon in the past, and he just posted on Twitter, Nathan Lyon hashtag mother cricket, with a sort of raised eyebrows, just to say, yeah, you know, maybe you should keep your mouth shut sometimes, mate. Now, obviously, that compelling drama has got us all indoors today on a glorious day in England. One man who was watching it, who wasn't missing the sunshine, though, was Ben Stokes' dad, who, of course, is living in New Zealand in Christchurch, but he wasn't going to miss this day for anything, even though it was in the middle of the night.
You know how you get a feeling sometimes that, you know, like, it would have been extremely good effort, but you feel like it's always possible for a team to win in that circumstance. Not just the, you know, like Ben doing so well, but for the team to hang in there and just, you know, having to do what they needed to do. You just had that feeling that was possible in that game. There's nothing like watching something live like that, you know, like if you miss it live, you'd be disappointed.
And what did you think of it? I mean, what was going through your mind?
Well, it was turning that impossible situation, and every ball that went and every six that went, you think, well, it is possible now. You know, you're watching what's happening, and you think maybe it's his time, you know, to do something like that. But not only that, it was at no stage did I feel like Jack Leach was under any pressure. Like he batted so well, you know, and he kept the pressure on Ben.
Yeah, I mean, he was incredibly composed. It was funny, actually, watching him cleaning his glasses and things like that every ball. Actually wasted a bit more time, which was quite good. And, yeah. I mean, obviously, Ben has had a remarkable summer. I mean, that's 2 superhuman efforts that he's put in, the World Cup final and now this. So where does he get it from? I mean, were you the kind of sportsman who never gave up?
Like, I think any sportsman who who's played at any level has an attitude, or some have an attitude that just never do that. Yeah, and I think, like, no matter what the odds were, you always go out there and do your best. It doesn't matter what. So you've always got to try and do that. You've always got to try and achieve that, even if the, you know, the probability of trying to get over the line in that situation was high, or the improbability. But because that you have a strong mental approach, you just want to do your best. And if your best is good enough, sometimes you come out on top. Not always, but you know.
But you have to have this. You have to have this sort of self-belief as well, which, I mean, is obviously there's an inbuilt self-belief in the Stokes kind of brotherhood, is there?
Well, we'd like to think so, yeah. Like, we'd like to think that we're all, we, you know, in any situation, there's always some light at the end of the tunnel, you know, like the sun always comes up tomorrow, doesn't it?
No, absolutely. And how are you feeling now, apart from absolutely exhausted?
Oh, very proud, you know, like, and it was just tremendous, you know, to see those sporting situations. I mean, like, even if Ben wasn't involved with that today, it's nice to be witness to a sporting situation. I mean, like, you know, sport takes us away from everything that's, you know, hard in our lives, and you see things like that, and the fairy tale finishes like that. I mean, that's just so special, isn't it?
Well, I spent a bit of time with Jed Stokes, actually, at the IPL in April and May, who followed Ben around playing for the Rajasthan Royals. He's a really interesting character. Of course, he played rugby league for New Zealand, and he came over to England to be a professional, to play for Workington, and it was him coming over as a professional that actually brought Ben eventually over to England when he was 13 to join his dad, to join the family, if you like. The family came over to live in England with Ben's dad, actually as coach at that point of Workington. But I just think it sort of says quite a lot about the family that Jed, when he was in the middle of his career playing in New Zealand, broke a finger about a month before he came to England to work as a professional, to play as a professional for Workington. And although every bit of medical advice said, mate, you've got to go and get this finger sorted, he just said, no, I'm not going to. I want to carry on. I want to play on. I'm going to miss my professional contract in England if I don't play on with it. So he strapped his middle finger to his index finger for the whole of a rugby league season. And when he got back to New Zealand at the end of that season, he found his finger was so badly damaged from all the playing and strapping it up and so on that it was irreparable. So he had the finger chopped off at the knuckle. Now, I mean, you know, it's an incredible story, that of commitment and valour and sort of die-hardiness, which clearly he's handed down to his son.
And well, and you saw that utter ruthlessness today, that sort of, that driven nature today in the innings that Stokes played. It was odds against all day, really. That's the thing. I mean, England away, they had a great morning session, and it all fell apart after lunch with those wickets, and he ran out Josh Butler as well. We can't forget that. So I don't know whether he felt a bit of extra responsibility, and then that ruthlessness took over, really, and then the adrenaline towards the end, some of those outrageous shots he played. He is technically an extremely good batsman. I think it's easy to forget that. You think back to that Cape Town innings where he was smashing everything. But the discipline he needed to play against Nathan Lyon, last week at Lords as well, and today with the ball turning out of the rough, the discipline he needed for that, and just to stay in, keep England in the game in that morning session, you know, was as remarkable in a way. Just reining himself in, biding his time, waiting for his opportunity. And then it all came out in one glorious, glorious display of hitting in the afternoon.
Yeah, so it was a mixture of, you know, test match application with sort of T20 thrown in, really, as an innings. And if we compare it to Ian Botham's great 149 not out at Headingley in 81, you know, Stokes' innings was a much finer innings, because although Botham turned the game and England had followed on and all that, and he completely changed the momentum of the match, quite a lot of that innings was lucky. You know, he got some lucky edges for four, and, you know, there's Skyers which sort of landed in the outfield and were luckily fell safe. You know, there's plenty of playing and missing and things like that. Whereas I think Stokes, although there were a couple of half chances to deep fielders, he didn't really give a chance, and he was examined by a range of excellent bowlers on a pitch which was helping a touch, and he just paced his innings and judged his innings so brilliantly.
Yeah, we should mention Jack Leach as well, of course, because without him at the other end, Stokes wouldn't have been able to do what he did. And he kept remarkably calm, only faced 17 balls. But when he was called upon, he did exactly what was required. And it was nice to see him get the single as well, just to nudge the scores level. And that was the moment when England knew they couldn't lose the match, which meant the Ashes were still alive at least. And then Stokes finished it off with that crunching shot through the offside and just sort of stood there, arms aloft, everyone roaring. And the noise as well at Headingley. It was sort of football crowd intense. It was, you know, winning goal in the last minute noise from the Headingley crowd. And it wasn't just right at the end as well. It was, you know, it was many, many times during the day. You know, the first run of the day was cheered, and everyone was standing up and getting behind him and shouting their encouragement. I watched the Australian supporters just away to our left-hand side, you know, as the presentations were starting. They were all just sloping off very quietly. I mean, what that must feel like for them and for the Australian team. I'm actually staying in the Australian team hotel, and there is absolutely rammed full of Australians. It'll be interesting to see what the atmosphere is like in this hotel this evening.
Well, it's why you play and watch the game, isn't it, for moments like this. Even if your team do lose, you know, it's the compelling drama of Test cricket, which is very hard to replicate in any other sport. I mean, it is the greatest game, without any doubt. And anybody who happened to see that action this afternoon and who doubted that Test cricket was an amazing spectacle will now hopefully have changed their mind. I wonder how Australia are going to come back from it, though. It's almost like a blow to the solar plexus, a hammer blow. I mean, they must have thought for most of that afternoon and the morning that they were going to win and that the Ashes were in their grasp and they were going to be holding up a miniature urn or an imaginary miniature urn tonight, having retained the Ashes. But now, suddenly, it's all in danger of slipping out of their grasp.
Yeah, and that is exactly what it was like in 1981. They were there just about, weren't they, in 1981. The series was in their grasp, and it was wrenched away from them by Ian Botham and Bob Willis. You talk about actually Botham's innings of 149 at Headingley. The innings he played at Old Trafford later in the series was a pure pedigree innings. That was the high-class innings of that summer. It was a glorious innings of striking, of really crisp striking of the ball. And, you know, that was more like the Stokes innings today, that innings. But of course, it wasn't played under such pressure. It wasn't played under, you know, the peril of losing the Ashes.
But you see, but the impact that Botham had from that performance had a very long-lasting effect on Australia. Every time he came into bat subsequently against Australia, they all thought, oh God, here we go again. I remember even in his last ever match against the Australians, which was for Durham, and it was his retirement match in 1993, and he bowled some lollipops. And I remember the Australians sitting in the Durham clubhouse sort of in awe, because they thought Botham would conjure up some wickets with a bunch of basically a load of old rubbish, really. And then he kept wicket in gloves and no pads and things like that. So he had this very powerful aura over Australia from 1981 on. And they must be thinking, Stokes has got the potential to do the same. I mean, he's had a wonderful summer. He's turned the World Cup in England's favour, and now he's won the Test match and kept the Ashes alive. And they must think they're in the presence of a higher being.
Well, he's having the summer of his life. And I think what was noticeable after the Bristol incident, everything that's happened subsequently, that determination to put sort of cricket right at the centre of everything, to put all that behind him. We saw him in Sri Lanka. You know, England would play a match. Some days it would be a bit restricted by rain, but he would, you know, the game would be playing. He would come back to the hotel and he would go to the gym and he would be working really hard, having played. So, and they had to sort of, I think they were a bit worried that he was doing too much. They wanted him to sort of rein himself back in. It was that sort of commitment, that sort of drive that we were talking about earlier that has sort of taken over his cricket. And because he is such a high class cricketer as well, because he's got that fine technique as a batsman, and you know, he's a very, very good bowler as well. It's a pretty irresistible package. 1-1 now, on to Old Trafford. Australia got a bit of respite. I suppose that's the one thing for Australia, is that they've got a big gap now between the Headingley Test match and the Old Trafford Test match. They've got a game at Derby, a three-day game, which Steve Smith, we are thinking, is going to play in. He's had a net today, and, you know, with a view to playing at Derby, and I'm sure he will. And then, you know, it's, the Smith show resumes, England up against Steve Smith, and that was, you know, irresistible earlier in the series, and then that fascinating battle rejoined between him and Jofra Archer.
Yeah, I mean, his aura of invincibility has certainly been burst, hasn't it, to an extent. And Stokes has now got this aura around him instead. So England should be feeling confident. But, you know, a lot can happen in those 9 days, actually. And there could be some injuries. There could be, I mean, Jimmy Anderson, I suppose, will try and make a claim to come back into the England side. So it sets it all up absolutely brilliantly, doesn't it? Thank goodness, in a way, that it's kept the series alive, because there's nothing worse than playing the last two test matches knowing that the Ashes is not at stake. And it just keeps the ever-encroaching elephant of football squashing everything else in its path, at least, can be just kept at bay for another couple of weeks.
Yeah, it's fantastic that the Ashes are still alive. I'm not sure Australia will see it like that. You know, they would have loved to have clinched the match, probably gone on and win the series 4-0, but it gives a real fascination to Old Trafford and the Oval. I mean, I hope that it's still alive at the Oval. It would be fantastic to have a clincher, wouldn't it, at the Oval final game. I suppose for that to happen, it means Australia can't win at Old Trafford. If they do, then, you know, as we were, it's a series clincher or an Ashes clincher. For it not to happen, it had to be a draw at Old Trafford or an England win, and then Australia have to win at the Oval to square the series and retain the Ashes. That certainly would be something. I mean, what we need as well, we need decent weather. We've had fantastic weather for this Headingley Test match, and I think that added to the occasion, actually. It was a, you know, really warm late summer's day at Headingley. It was one of those sort of glorious days of cricket. You know, even if Australia had won by one run, which, you know, they should have done, they could have done, if umpire Joel Wilson had raised his finger, I think even then you would have said, what a day's cricket we've seen. What a fight back by England. Australia just at the end, as England did in 2005 when they won it just at the end. But it was not to be. It went England's way today, and, well, we got two mouth-watering matches lined up for September.
Yes, we have. It's been an absolute privilege to watch today's match, and I hope lots of you were able to see it. It is the fourth time that England have won a test match by one wicket, and obviously it's created this Superman status of Ben Stokes, so it's tremendously exciting and wonderful for the Stokes family as well. So as I promise, we're going to leave you today with a little episode from Cricket's Greatest Rivalry, the history of the Ashes in 12 matches. And this episode is from a match we've already alluded to. It was the Oval in 1902, with Gilbert Jessop performing very much like Ben Stokes did today. The 1902 Ashes had been won, but the series was not finished. The fifth test at the Oval was some finale. The feud between Lord Hawke and Archie MacLaren had been settled, and both Gilbert Jessop and George Hurst were restored to the England team. Australia fielded the same side that had won at Old Trafford, batted first and made 324. England were caught on a tricky pitch and managed only 183, Hurst top scoring with 43 after taking 5 wickets in the Australian innings. Hugh Trumbull bowled 31 overs unchanged to take 8 for 65. When Australia went into bat for the second time with a lead of 141, the incomparable Trumper set off for a quick single, fell flat on his face and was run out. Australia collapsed and were bowled out for 121. It left England to make 263 for a morale-boosting victory, but at 10 for 3 and then 48 for 5, with the Aussie spin twins of Saunders and Trumbull tying them in knots, all hope seemed lost. It was the stroke of lunchtime on the third and final day. Many disgruntled members gathered up their belongings and headed home, unwilling to see England further humiliated. Enter Jessop, the croucher, as he was known for his wide, hunch stance. A big hitting Botham Eskall rounder who loved eating beef, he was described in Gloucestershire circles as a human catapult who wrecks the roofs of distant towns when set in his assault. He was completely fearless as evidenced by the fact that he never wore a box when he batted, or maybe he was a masochist. A man who once clubbed the Yorkshire bowling for 100 in 45 minutes, Jessop was a 2020 specialist a century before it came to prominence. He was not one for playing himself in. He scored off all the first six balls he faced and lofted Trumbull into the pavilion. After surviving a stumping chance and a catch to long off, he sent a ball from Saunders skimming over cover point and another over the bowler's head. After lunch, he cut Trumbull for an all-run five and struck the nervy Saunders for five consecutive boundaries. He put on 109 in partnership with Jackson, who eventually hit a return catch into Trumbull's gigantic hands. Hurst joined Jessop with 106 still wanted. He survived a confident LBW shout and flayed the tiring Saunders. Jessop launched Trumbull over the pavilion roof for six, pulled Saunders for four, but had trouble with Armstrong's slow leg breaks. On 96, he hauled Armstrong to the fence to reach his 100. It had taken him just 75 minutes, and in terms of time, it is still the fastest 100 in Ashes history. Adam Gilchrist's whirlwind effort in 2006 took 103 minutes. 1,000 straw boaters were flung in the air, and the cheering of the crowd could be heard in Clapham. The daredevilry of Jessop's innings can only be imagined, but it must have been not unlike Ian Botham's barnstorming knock at Headingley in 1981, a mixture of brilliance, bravado and outrageous luck. C.B. Fry later wrote that no man has ever driven the ball so hard, so high and so often in so many different directions. But attempting a delicate sweep, Jessop brought his innings to a tame end on 104. It's what happens when swashbuckling hitters think they are real batsmen and try to play properly. Now, with 76 needed, Hurst took over, batting with great common sense and control. He lost Lockwood, the eighth wicket, at 214, and the busy wicketkeeper Lilly at 248. It was now 15 to win, with one wicket left. In walked Wilfred Rhodes, Hurst's Kirk Heaton and Yorkshire colleague. The story goes that Hurst greeted him with, "We'll get 'em in singles, Wilfred." It was refuted by Rhodes himself. Well, anyway, no one could be that cool. And he opened his account with a lucky-edged four. He was subsequently dropped at slip by Warwick Armstrong, but he remained calm and composed, while Hurst, twirling his bat furiously between balls and constantly patting down imperfections on the pitch, was focused and determined. The tension in the ground was unbearable. Every one of the 22,000 people in the ground was keeping score. England's last pair inched closer, nudging singles on the leg side in spite of Darling changing the field every ball. They crowded round Rhodes, but he was the best number 11 England ever had and held firm. With three to win, Hurst drove Noble's medium pace wide of mid-on. They thought about two, but decided against it, so Rhodes played out the rest of the over. Hurst used his feet to the relentless Trumbull, who had bowled unchanged through the innings, and the batsman took another quick single. A huge roar went up in recognition of the scores now being level. A clergyman, who thought England had won, charged onto the field, pursued by a policeman. Sounds more like a scene from Laurel and Hardy. The field was moved again, with the sturdy batsman Reggie Duff posted at deep long on. A strange position to be in when the number 11 is on strike, with one run to win. An Australian in the crowd shouted, "Never mind, Duff, you've won the Ashes!" Then Rhodes hit Trumbull in his direction, and everyone ran, the batsman for the winning single, the fielders for the ball, and the spectators who'd been sitting in rapt attention for about 6 hours, onto the field. The noise and turmoil and prolonged cheering were the witness of the best finish, wrote the Manchester Guardian. It surpassed the Manchester game in excitement, and it is difficult to say more. In spite of that heroic last wicket partnership, the game has gone down in folklore as Jessop's match. The concept of man of the match was not formalised until the founding of the Gillette Cup 61 years later. So no free shaving gear for Gilbert. The euphoria was brief. England had lost the Ashes after all, and the country was still recovering from the recently concluded Boer War, which had cost 22,000 lives. And there were more pressing concerns, like the appalling health of a nation which, according to the Daily Telegraph, was a raucous, grasping multitude, good enough at pushing through the turnstiles or bellowing at a footballer, but who have no notion of taking any decent exercise for themselves at any time. Plus ça change, non?
Podcast Network.